And title meeting, title 9 committee meeting to order. First item is public comment, of which we have received no public comment. Number 2 is our consent items. I would like to pull 2E, but I would take a motion for accepting all of the other consent items. So moved by Regent Hayes. I'm sorry, we have to do roll call. If we can have roll call.
Chair Carter.
Here.
Vice Chair Hayes.
Here.
Regent Del Carlo. Regent McMichael.
Here.
Regent Perkins.
Here.
You do have a quorum.
Thank you. And on back to item number 2, consent items. I would like to pull 2E. And we have a motion from Regent Hayes to accept those consent items. Do we have a second?
Second.
Second from Regent Perkins. All in favor say aye. Aye. All opposed?
Aye.
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 So 2E is a follow-up. So that motion passes. 2E is a follow-up on the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. So on our audit, I'll let Mr. Sunbury explain.
Thanks, Chair Carter. For the record, Jill Sunbury. So this committee heard findings from Grant Thornton's Uniform Guidance Audit Report at its December 2019 meeting. And at that meeting, Chair Carter requested a follow-up on one of the newer findings, specifically 2019-007. This related to the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, specifically student information security. So the original finding from Grant Thornton is included in the attached reference materials. The institutions mentioned in the finding, which were CSN, TMCC, UNLV, and WNC, were asked to prepare a brief summary indicating any action taken to date, any planned action, or estimated time of completion. So those status updates are also included in the reference materials for the committee's approval. In summary, the original finding noted institutions didn't provide proper evidence of performance of a risk assessment that addressed 3 required areas as set forth in the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. The institution responses incorporate a timeline for addressing the risk assessment requirement, and all have made steps toward formalization. All institutions have either adopted the risk assessment template provided by NC Internal Audit and SCS, or have contracted an external consultant to complete an independent assessment. It is expected that these risk assessments will be completed by June of this year, depending on which approach was adopted. Thank you.
So once again, just to reiterate, there was at our big audit from outside, we found that a few institutions did not have a plan according to the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. And so those few institutions that didn't, we followed up on, and now they've submitted plans. We'll probably once again follow up to make sure that those plans are finalized and implemented. So I would entertain a motion to accept this consent item.
So moved.
Regent Del Carlo and
Regent Del Carlo.
Hayes seconded. Any discussion? All in favor say aye. Aye. All
aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
This motion passes. So item number 3, Center for Academic Enrichment and Outreach, UNLV. Before I turn it over to Mr. Sunbury, I'll read my disclosure. I was previously a student in the gaming innovation course at UNLV where I developed a casino game. If that game is marketed and sold, I'll be required to pay UNLV in the form of shared royalties pursuant to a standard contract that all students in the course were required to sign. I will receive no remuneration from UNLV. I disclose this relationship under NRS Chapter 28180 as recommended by the Nevada Commission on Ethics. As this item does not affect my interests, I will be voting on this agenda item. Mr. Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury, Chief Internal Auditor. So in the audit summary document, I've included a table of reports being presented today along with key observations. And before I get started, just wanted to reach out and say thank you to each of the institutions who have reports being presented today. In each case, obviously, we were working remotely with the institutions to push these over the finish line, and their willingness to make that happen and still give us a full agenda of deliverables here today. It simply couldn't have happened without their collaboration, so thank you so much. The first audit report for discussion today is the Center for Academic Enrichment and Outreach at UNLV. The report includes a general overview about CAO's operations around the Valley, including some graphs showing dozens of federal-funded programs that are managed and millions of revenue dollars overseen. So with that perspective in mind, Internal Audit's opinion is that CAO is operating in a satisfactory manner. But we did bring forward what are hopefully useful recommendations for improvement going forward. I won't go through them verbatim, but in general, those include opportunities for control enhancement and documentation improvements surrounding travel, participant support, and volunteers, enhancements to vehicle management policies and procedures, and ensuring that Office of Sponsored Programs captures effort reporting properly. Thank you.
I would entertain a motion to accept this.
I'll move to accept, but I'll have some thoughts before the...
Regent vote. Hayes motions to approve. Is there a second?
Second.
Yes. Regent McMichael, and then Regent Hayes has some comments.
Yeah, I just had some concerns with... I'm looking at all... As we're going through it, there's all these tickets that were bought, and obviously the audit captured that they weren't properly documented. But there are a ton of, whether it's Wet and Wild or movie tickets, that were purchased and unissued. Were these purchased immediately prior to the pandemic and that's why they weren't issued? Or have people been making these multi-$1,000 purchases and then they just sit in a drawer somewhere? Obviously, capturing the, making sure it's properly documented keeps us out of a situation like the Southwest Airline cards did at the LVCVA, but... Why are they spending money on these if they're not being used? Is there anyone that could address that?
President Miena?
I cannot, but I will ask my CFO, Jean Vaughk, to speak to this. Is she online? Is Jean Vaughk online?
Is Jean Vaughk online, Blue Jeans?
Yes, I am. I'm trying to... can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
All right, thank you. Give me just a minute to adjust. Yes, thank you for the question. I don't have all the details. And by the way, for the record, Jean Vaughk, UNLV CFO, and just want to address briefly the organizations, the grants that are managed by CAEO provide a lot of opportunities for younger students to get engaged in programs and opportunities to learn more about higher education and be prepared. The specific volume will vary based on when they have an opportunity to purchase at a discount. They will purchase those, and then they'll distribute them as needed. I don't have the specifics, but I can certainly get more information about the specific tickets. But they purchase those when they can get them in volume, and that's why they have that volume.
Yeah, if Chair Carter,
for Regent Hayes.
If we could get some follow-up, I mean, because a lot of these, it's like 90%+ of the tickets purchased remain unused. So I get buying them in bulk and volume, but if they're not actually being used and they're sitting in a drawer somewhere, one, it's opportunity for someone to misuse them, but second, it's just wasted money that is not being used to, you know, as I read through the policy, they're supposed to be used for incentives to encourage kids to come and participate in our programs. But we're not using that incentive, so I'd just like to get some follow-up on why that is. And
certainly, I'll provide some additional follow-up on that.
Okay. Any other discussion?
Yes, this is Regent McMichael.
Yes, Regent McMichael.
Are any of these items have expiration dates?
Maybe Jean Vaughk?
Jean Vaughk, for the record. Did you want me to address that?
Sure, please.
Yeah. Again, I'll have to give you follow-up, so I don't have that information right at the time, but I will follow up on both of those questions.
Okay. So, yeah, we'll do
some
follow-up here because there's those tickets. There's another set of 250, so there's 1,000 tickets. Some were issued to participants. Some weren't issued. Some have no record of where they went to. So I think there's a lot of good guidance in here for going forward, but I think it might be useful to also look back and see what we can see what they did here as well. So, any other discussion? Yes.
What were the funds used? Because I know a lot of these programs are federally funded from my past history working for a member of Congress. So I just want to make sure the expenses aren't being used with federal funds that then can't be shown were actually used for a good use, or have the receipts to show what they were used for. Because not only could that be an issue for an audit with this body, it could be an issue with a much larger body. So I just want to make sure you can clarify that.
Any other discussion? Could we have a motion and a second? All in favor of accepting this audit, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion passes. On to item number 4, Child Development Center, WNC. Mr. Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Jill Sunbury. We've looked at a few of these child care centers at various institutions around NSHE in recent years. These have made our radar in terms of risk assessment, since anytime you have minors on campus, there's increased risks in terms of certain regulatory items, operational risk, reputation risk, additional Nevada revised statutes to consider, et cetera. WNC, I think, perhaps leveraged some of these past audits or at least paid attention, because they were really on top of things in just about every major item we considered. So kudos to them on what was a very clean audit. We had just a couple of minor recommendations related to identifying compensating controls to mitigate fairly common segregation of duties issues, as well as increasing their documentation of certain key accounting processes so that if or when an employee leaves or there's turnover, all of that knowledge doesn't walk out the door. Thanks.
Thank you. Origen Hayes?
Who's our legal counsel on this one? Is it Z?
Z.
Yes. Do I need to disclose? Well, I guess I'll disclose by asking that my children attended this this school during the 2015 session of the legislature. Do I need to make that disclosure? Or, I mean, we're just a regular customer, but it will not affect my ability to vote on this impartially in any way.
I think the fact now that you have disclosed it is sufficient, Regent Hayes.
Thanks.
Any more discussion? So I would entertain a motion. Regent Hayes?
So moved.
And when Laura Perkins second. So we have a motion. Any other discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
All aye. Opposed.
Aye.
Motion passes. So we'll go on to item number 5, Dental Faculty Practice CSN. Mr. Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury, Chief Internal Auditor. I noted in the audit summary that we originally identified dental faculty practice as part of our overall revenue controls audit, and we felt it was worth its own review on this year's audit plan. The deliverable for this report looks a little different than our traditional deliverable, and I just want to take a brief moment and walk through why. So we're always looking for fresh approaches to our risk assessment, and last year my team came across a great article that talked about failures in auditing, and it defined failure in auditing, and I'm slightly paraphrasing, as spending way too much time looking at stuff nobody cares about. And, you know, the article talked further about different ways to just evolve in how you're assessing risk, with the ultimate goal being focusing on what matters and what's significant. And that's something my team's continued to work toward, and ultimately how we want to measure success. So we took one of these approaches called facilitated discussion and piloted it with CSN's dental faculty practice. So this involved working with the institution to collectively identify risks. One of the benefits of this approach is it's very much in line with what we tried to be strategically as a department, less about the gotcha aspect and more about the value-add partnership. So this approach literally shifts that dynamic within the relationship. The idea behind this approach is you split the audit into two parts. The first part is identifying risks with the department. An audit, still using its appropriate levels of independence and skepticism, identifies gaps, makes recommendations. All of this is documented, done in agreement with management, and then we go away. We give the department time to work on these identified matters, come back 6 to 9 months later, and essentially with that narrow focus of risks identified in mind, ensure the department has made the appropriate changes and improvements. And where they haven't quite gotten there, we keep that on the radar like we would with any traditional audit deliverable within this committee. So with that approach in mind, we collectively agreed that well-documented procedures, policies are going to be a driver to reduce some of these residual risks. Examples noted in the report are accounts receivable balance, accuracy and tracking, consistency and write-off policies. And we've previously identified the deficit balance and recognized that this is very much on the radar of the board with additional tracking mechanisms in place. Thank you.
So this has been an issue for a good while, and I have lots of discussion points, but I would love to entertain discussion from any other regents first. Regent Hayes?
Yeah, I mean, this is an issue that I, more than most that we hear on the audit committee, I've actually heard from people in the community, and when I was in one of my most vulnerable positions, laying straight on my back with my head down and a man with sharp instruments digging into my mouth telling me that we cannot, that'd be my dentist, telling me that we cannot let this program go away and telling me how important it is, you know, as we've all read in the paper about the financial struggles. And then I see that they've got $370,000 in accounts receivable that are more than 90 days late. We want to help you. We've heard great things about this program from the community. We know it's got financial troubles. But when this program's shooting itself in the foot by not even going after its own accounts receivables, how can we help this? You know, it's frustrating. I mean, by all accounts, it's a great program, but we can't continue to lose money on it. And when they're leaving money sitting on the table, it just makes us it harder for us to justify.
Other discussion?
How do I see? See me? See, see me?
Regent Del Carlo?
Thank you, Chair Carter. Yeah, I concur with that. I was really disturbed by this audit, and I you can't see my screen, but the accounts receivable on this board pack is awfully yellow because there's so many basic things that aren't being done there. I mean, I was just really shocked, and in these very very stressful economic times, whoever's responsible has got to take immediate responsibility and get this thing turned around and get turned around fast. I don't think CSN can afford the luxury of feeding this into those high dollar amounts. And maybe it is a great program and it's good for the students to practice and the dentists, but it seems to me we had a dental problem there a long time ago on just the salary of a dentist, but that's something else. But I mean, there's five items here. And you're hiring, I think I read that you're hiring somebody. There's not even somebody in charge right now. This really looks like a train wreck. So we got to get this thing taken care of.
So I'll piggyback on that. So we've had losses. We all know about the losses, but then it just gets really frustrating. So like our original audit went in there and there's no policies and procedures. And then you look later when the person that was supposed to make the policies and procedures doesn't exist, so they're blaming it on a person that's not there, and then a person leaves, and now we're still in the same position. We don't really have all the policies and procedures, and the head of the thing is not there. It's losing money. I think this warrants a huge discussion on really if this is a viable thing as we're looking at budget cutbacks and trying to make money where we're maybe going to approve a union contract that's going to have a raise. Like, this seems like really easy money to cut on a program that is incredibly disorganized. And that's just my thoughts. I mean, there's just so many specific areas that you could dig through in this report to identify. I don't know if there's a base to build off of outside of its original reputation that it had when I first got on the board, where the movement and people and culture were saying, hey, we need to keep this and preserve it. But I haven't seen any movement in my 4 years on the board to justify why we're still looking at this exact same problem with losses and lack of procedures and all kinds of crazy stuff. I don't know if Zaragoza, if you want to address any of that.
I do, and I echo some of the concerns. I think we've discussed this in previous committee meetings in terms of the corrective action plans that we plan to address for this program. And I want to emphasize the value of not only to the community in terms of the service, but we have about 200 dental hygienists and dental assisting students that actually take their clinicals in that facility. So it's not always a dollars and cents kind of scenario. There are issues associated with the management of the program, and so we've tried to address it from that context. That in fact, this was one of the first programs that we reorganized under the multi-campus structure, and so we now have our campus provost, Dr. Sonia Pearson, who is the chief administrator for the DFP and has been working with the staff and with the audit teams to kind of create a much more accountable system. And I believe that Dr. Pearson is on the line, so I want to give her the opportunity, as she already addressed many of the issues that were addressed in this audit during the exit interviews. So if Dr. Pearson is online, I'd appreciate it.
Hello, everyone. This is Sonia Pearson, campus provost for the West Charleston campus at CSN. I couldn't agree more with all of the comments that have been shared. And I think one of the most troubling aspects will turn out to be our most greatest opportunity to turn this program around. There's nothing within this audit report in my 30 years of working with similar programs that cannot be overcome and should not have been overcome. I think we've just really gotten into a heavy practice of this is how we've always done it, without proper quality assurance and monitoring activities along the way. As Dr. Zaragoza mentioned to you all, during the course of the audit, there were some matters that were already cleared up. There were five core audit areas. Two of those areas had been resolved by the time the audit follow-up audit review occurred. The most significant area that actually needs traction is the policies and procedures manual. And we all know that with these type of practices, you can't operate without having something memorialized in writing. So over the last 30 days, I've worked with this team and they have been great to respond. And we actually have a draft audit plan that's been reviewed by the COVID-19 team, as well as our campus compliance officer, and is covering a broad gamut of operational procedures all the way from communication with patients, management of patient records, so on and so forth. So I am pleased to say that that traction has been made. But when you look back in terms of what wasn't done then, this is another great example of there was no reason why we couldn't have completed that manual. I just think we got into a practice of we know what to do. This is the way it's always been done, and we've just been moving. The other significant area that warrants attention is the financial side of the house, the collections, the accounts receivable, accounts payable, all those related activities. Again, this has aligned with some historical practices of, you know, we're monitoring it based upon day-to-day things, but we're not taking a comprehensive view. I have since worked with the DFP and also received some great feedback and collaboration from our fiscal officer, Mary Kay, and I have a financial plan that clearly is identified for the DFP that is looking at not just managing on resources coming in from patients. And of course, we have this interesting dynamic where we are not supposed to gain revenue. That's fine, but we should not be operating in the red. We all understand that. This comprehensive financial plan talks about we need to tap into some external resources like grants to offset personnel costs, to operate, offset some operational costs. It also talks about what type of partnerships are we forming that will align with the mission and purpose and priorities rather than looking at just simple walk-ins. So we have reached out to Clark County Social Services Division, the Department of Health and Human Services, and have those partnerships that were evolving just before COVID-19. We wrote for a $250,000 grant, and we're waiting for an answer to that by July 1. Hopefully we receive that. But it doesn't remove the fact that we need to have proper financial monitoring of collections. I am pleased to report that the collection rate has not only been increased from what it was historically, which was about maybe 60%, we are now benchmarking at above industry standards at 80 to 90%. I received some caution from the team that, you know, that's really aggressive, but my goal working with them is always to aim above industry standard, because if we fall below, we're still doing well. So last month, we were at 90% collection rate with that model. So I'm confident that we have the right plan. And just before the COVID-19, the DFP had experienced an increase in revenue and not a month of deficit for the first time. And it was built on the financial plan that I'm sharing with you all right now. So I do believe we have the right plan. When things start to stabilize after COVID-19, I think we're going to be able to accelerate that. There was a comment from one of the other regions in regards to we're hiring someone. That is another significant area that will continue to keep the DFP in the black hole, and this is why. We've hired individuals above and beyond industry pay rates. We can't do that in a practice of this type. We've also hired individuals, one individual to oversee the accounts receivable without a balancing and leveraging of technology and outside vendors. So with that in mind, that is part of the financial plan and the council's receivable plan that I have worked with the DFP to create. That's in response to the audit. And let me get to the audit itself. That was somewhat of a surprise situation where I think there could have been a much more comprehensive approach to who's going to be accountable for the prior audit recommendations and findings. We have since closed that gap, and right now the Dean for Health Sciences is the core agent as the administrator who will monitor the day-to-day operations of completing the audit action items. And I will also serve as someone to make sure there's proper training, collaboration with the other divisions. My thing is I'm putting them on a 30, 60, 90-day plan. So every 30, 60, 90 days, I need to see some results, and I'm pleased to say that they are responding to that appropriately. I've ran operations like this before from child care centers, on-campus health centers, and the plan that I'm deploying with this group is one that has proven to be successful at other institutions. So I hope this addressed some of your questions, but it's not here to dismiss the reality that we need to get this right. But it's not going to be one approach. It has to be a comprehensive, integrated, systemic approach to this, and that's what I'm doing with the team.
Regent Hayes?
Yeah, Regent Carter, I may bring this up in new business, but you know, look, from what I've heard, this has been described as the Cadillac of programs, and that it is one of the best in the country with what we do. However, I'm not sure that we can, in these budget times, afford a Cadillac. And we may need to look at restructuring this program, or ask CSN to look at restructuring this program to align with what is more common practice across the country. I would hate to lose that. We've talked a lot about workforce development. A couple years ago, we talked a lot about the good jobs, those jobs that are created by associate's degrees and certificates that pay $60,000 to $80,000 a year. And we need those in this community. However, in these budget times, losing $500,000 this year, can we subsidize the good jobs we're creating through this program to the tune of $500,000? I don't know the answer to that. We heard about new programs and new practices in place, the hiring of someone. I'm going to suggest now, or again in new business, that we have them come back in September, give us a presentation on what these new plans are, what the plan is to dig out of the hole, why we need this Cadillac of programs in order to train this workforce as opposed to the model that's used in the rest of the country. And just take a look at it as a board. I'd love to keep this program. I've heard amazing things about it, but we've got to make tough decisions right now. We've got huge budget cuts coming. So that would be my recommendation.
Other discussion? Anybody else?
Mr. Chairman, Laura Perkins here.
Yes.
I have a question. I guess it's for Dr. Pearson. Do you really think the changes that you've made will make it be able to at least break even? And how long do you think that might that look?
Okay. Excellent question. And I do want to address the prior comment as well and recommendation regarding a restructure. I don't see the DFP moving to stabilize without some form of restructure that does align with industry standards and best practices. And that's what I'm infusing in discussion with the group and the plan that I've created with that team. When you talk about stabilizing things and actually getting it back to operational processes in the black, there's several things that must happen. We have to really closely look at the staffing model for this. In models like this, you don't have a lot of permanent full-time individuals where if you need to make adjustments in a program, now you're stuck where you still have to pay the salary if you get rid of aspects of the program. That's the kind of what we're stuck in right now. We're going to have to revisit that. The other thing is that you cannot solely rely upon institutional dollars, is what I like to call it. You have to leverage that with some strategic external resources. That is a huge driver in those partnerships. So when I look at those core elements, I would say that by September, we should be able to show, and we should be showing, significant progress towards leveling this deficit, if not eliminating it. I will keep in mind, with a point of sensitivity, that the COVID-19 situation didn't help any, because that added a significant amount of financial deficits to us, because we had to shut down operations, and we were only able to provide emergency services. So with that, that is another situation that we're going to have to overcome. When you get to the collections, there's a large amount of money that I feel like the DFP should have written off some time ago, because it's in a bucket that is uncollectible at this point, and that is aligned with industry standards. But yet our internal procedures did not have a formalized write-off process to evaluate those things. And that is something that we're adopting right now as well, and working with our fiscal office to make sure it is compliant and one aligned with industry standards, so we don't continue to carry forward maybe debts that were not collectible from insurance companies. And the ultimate thing is, we have to keep our operations correct with the industry standards. If we bring in certain individuals to operate the DFP, and it's not individuals that will align with insurance procedures, we can't collect on certain services that we provided. And there's been some of those type of situations that we're trying to overcome. I believe that we will not have everything cleared up by September, because we're still trying to get out of the COVID-19 situation as well. But I do think we need to start showing some significant improvements. And that's why I have them on the 30, 60, 90-day plan. So reporting out in September, then coming back and reporting out in another 30 to 60 days to see if we are actually making the traction that the board wants to see, that the college wants to see, and also our community, so we can sustain this program.
Any other discussion?
Thank you for the in-depth answer.
I just want to say, you know, this is something that we brought up when we hired Dr. Z, and we're here a couple years later, and this doesn't seem to have gotten any better. I know there's been a lot of turnover in some positions. We can't just keep on passing the buck to people that are no longer with us. I know, Ms. Pearson, this is not your fault that it's this way. You just started with us. But at the same time, like, I think we ask a couple times nicely, and then after a couple times asking nicely, we got to do something else. And I think we're to that phase now where we're red alert. You got to do something. This is not going to be sustainable. This is not going to work. So you have to do something. I'll accept a motion to accept this audit.
I have a comment, please.
Sure.
I have a comment
please.
First.
No, Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Carter. I agree that this has not gotten better, but what I'm hearing today is that Dr. Pearson is new. She's identified the problem, and she's taking corrective action. I, as a leader, you've taken accountability and responsibility for it, and I'm really pleased to hear you say that today. And I think we should give her the time, the 30, 60, 90 plan, and if it's under new business, or I can say it now, and have her come back at our quarterly board meetings until we're satisfied with this. Because as someone stated earlier, I think it was you, Dr. Pearson, that all of the students use this for their testing and their practice plan. This is their practice plan for their hygiene program and everything, correct? So, I mean, where would we do this if we weren't doing it internally? So there's value there, but we've just got to get it right the ship, and I have confidence Dr. Pearson's going to do that. So let's give her time to do it.
So I would entertain a motion to accept this audit. Regent Hayes, do I have a second?
Second.
Regent Del Carlo, any other discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye. All opposed?
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. We'll move on to item number 6, Sponsored Projects UNR. Mr. Sunbury.
Thanks, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury.
So this particular audit, as noted, has compliance-related findings, control enhancement suggestions in areas like effort reporting, cash management, award closeout, cost sharing, and expenditures. These are all areas you'd expect to take a look at when doing kind of a deeper dive of sponsored projects. Just want to say I'm appreciative of the hard work my team put in on this, as well as the institution's assistance along the way. Thanks.
Any discussion? Seeing none, do I have a motion to accept this audit?
So moved.
Regent Hayes, do I have a second? Regent Del Carlo, any other discussion? All in favor of accepting this audit, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? This motion passes. Item number 7, Internal Audit Compliance and Title IX Updates, INCHI. I'll start us off briefly if you don't mind. So the Title IX stuff finally did pass from the federal government, and that's going to be coming back to our committee probably in the next 30 days with some proposed changes. There's a couple committees meeting. I think our attorney wanted to say a few words about that as well, the Title IX updates.
Yes, Chair Carter, this is Alalan Bogala, Deputy General Counsel for Assistant Administration at INCHI. Chief General Counsel Joe Reynolds has tasked me with leading a task force to review and to implement the new rule that was issued by the Department of Education under Title IX by the August 14th date. And that's the date set by the Department of Education. And so that task force is comprised of legal representatives from the universities and community colleges, as well as the Title IX coordinators from both of the universities. And so we've met several times, I think 6 or 7 times now. We're trying to meet twice a week to get through the new rule. It's over 2,000 pages long. So there's quite a lot of ground to cover, but we are, I think, on schedule and should have some proposed revisions to show, to stakeholders in the system, including the Faculty Alliance, the student groups, as well as the Board of Regents, and hopefully get that passed prior to the 14th of August.
Thank you. Mr. Sunbury?
Thank you, Chair Carter. If I may just piggyback off of that, I do want to point out, just for the record, that in early May, when the Department of Education released its updated Title IX rules, that really immediately upon that release, ENCHI Legal Counsel was in touch. I know the chair and vice chair of this committee were copied on an email that they were getting up to speed on those new rules and beginning to draft the necessary proposed amendments to the handbook, procedures, and guidelines manual. And the communication has been great along the way. I just wanted to get that on the record. In terms of the other areas, you know, in the spirit of time, we combined this section into that normally would be 3 separate agenda items. It's now the internal audit compliance and Title IX updates. So we've already touched on one of those 3 pillars. So I'll just hit briefly on the other 2, starting with internal audit. Since our last committee meeting, it's been interesting to watch my team adjust and evolve, and I certainly want to thank them on the record for their efforts and productivity these last 12 weeks. In April, the Institute of Internal Audit's Audit Executive Center sent out a quick poll to internal audit shops around the country, and I was glad to participate in that. And they published the results fairly recently, and overall it showed that audit functions really around the country are working toward, you know, quickly updating their audit plans, updating their risk assessments. Nearly 4 in 10 respondents have added new engagements due to COVID-19 or have redirected staff to put aside normal audit work to assist organizations in the crisis, even if it's non-audit work. So I'm happy to say we're on the good side of each of those polls. And fairly early in the work from home directive, I was able to have conversations with key stakeholders around the system, including all the business officers, about updated risks, where internal audit could best be utilized during these times. And we've adjusted our path where necessary, and we're going to continue these conversations. And I share this with the committee because I think it's indicative of where we're headed, and certainly would welcome the committee's input and direction. But I think you know, the more timely we can have these discussions, the better. And I think this is kind of naturally and organically moving us away from the static one-year plan that that I would typically present to this committee in September, and essentially moving toward maybe a more often updated, perhaps a semi-annual audit plan. I think this approach is good for a few reasons. I can give the audit committee more or less a real-time snapshot of what we're working on, and it further commits my team to tighter timeframes to complete these audit results, allows us to be more agile to adjust to the needs of institutions, and it can help us adjust real-time resources for hotline-related items whenever those come up, and I'll talk about those in a little bit. All of this in line is really what's happening nationally with internal audit departments. So something I'd bring forward for further consideration in September, but I did just want to throw that out there to the committee now in case there's any questions or concerns. And I'll pause there if there are any questions before I go into compliance updates. Thanks.
Any questions from any of the members of the committee so far? Regent Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment on the Title IX work. You know, this is the first new rules issued on Title IX guidance in a long time. The universities and colleges around the country have been working off of a couple of Dear Colleague letters from several years ago. And for them to have a 2,000-page new rule book put out in May and for us to be able to comply by August 14th is a lot of work. And I know Z and his team have been meeting a ton, and I just want to say I appreciate their efforts. There are some good things in the rules, some bad things, some unclear things, and there's a whole lot to get through. And for us to be on track to be in compliance with this by August 14th is phenomenal. Especially in this COVID-19 lockdown world. So I just wanted to thank you guys for all the work you're doing, you and the rest of the committee.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Any other questions to this point? Okay, Mr. Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. Joe Sunbury for the record. So in terms of compliance updates, the attached briefing memo provides some general background on the compliance hotline and how it came into existence. At the last meeting, Regent DiCarlo mentioned that since it's been around for a year plus, it'd be great to see some kind of report on how we're doing. And I was putting some thought into how I was going to honor that request for the committee, and quite honestly, just completely lucked out that the company that administers our hotline came out with their benchmarking report in late April. So this created some natural reporting metrics and buckets. So you'll see on the second page of the reference materials that benchmarking category percentages compared to what we're seeing with ENSHE's activity. So I thought it would be useful to just take a couple quick minutes, run through the definitions of the category categories very quickly. And these are provided by Navex Global, who provided the benchmark information. And I'm using their specific examples provided because, as a reminder, this is a confidential hotline. So I wouldn't want to inadvertently reference a specific ongoing matter. So, very quickly, the category definitions. Number one, accounting, auditing, and financial reporting. Very straightforward category. These are cases that pertain to those particular functions within an organization. Examples provided are financial misconduct, internal control circumvention, or expense reporting issues. Category two, business integrity. These are cases related to how an organization interacts with its third parties, including its customers. In our world, our students. Examples provided are bribery, falsification of documents, fraud, conflicts of interest, HIPAA, or other customer issues. Category three, HR diversity and workplace respect. Those are cases that involve internal parties and often relate to employee relations or misconduct. Examples provided discrimination, harassment, retaliation, and general HR and other issues. Category four, environment, health, and safety. Cases that involve an element of safety typically pertaining to employees, environmental regulations, or workplace health. So things like EPA compliance, public safety, OSHA, or substance abuse. And category five, misuse, misappropriation of corporate assets. Those are cases that specify company assets or time is being wasted or used in a manner other than what is expected. So think employee theft or time clock abuse. So as you look overall, and recognizing this is really our first full year of data, our graph looks pretty consistent with the benchmark information. The other item that I wanted to include from a benchmarking standpoint that I thought was important, and you can see in the blurb just below the colorful graph, was this concept of substantiation rate. Overall, the benchmark numbers had this number at 43%, and NSHE's current rate is at 35%, fairly close, but just under that mark. So as I noted in the briefing memo, a higher rate is indicative of a well-informed employee base and an effective investigation process. So thanks. I'll stop there for any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? I just want to say I love having the benchmark. We found that, or you found that, very shortly after the last meeting, and that just kind of establishes what we weren't really sure if the amount of calls coming in different categories was what typically happens or not. So these categories provided a great benchmark to compare that to, a barometer. Any discussion on this item? Yeah, Richard Hayes.
You're right. The chart is very helpful, but I was reading through. It tells percentage of which cases came in were under which bucket, but do we have any, and you have the substantiation rate, but do we have any data showing for institutions or organizations our size, are the number of calls coming in higher, lower, similar? We rolled this out just last year, so are we making enough people aware of its availability compared to other institutions or organizations?
Mr. Simbert.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hayes. That is something, so the benchmarking data does cover off on a number of industries. I think I will be able to drill down further specifically into education, possibly into higher education. I'm also part of a few listservs, if you will, where I can talk to other chief audit executives from other systems around the country and maybe at least get an informal poll as to, hey, what kind of volume are you guys seeing? I do think that is one of the areas we're averaging so far about 12 submissions, 12 cases a quarter, I don't know exactly if that's high or low. It does seem to be coming in fairly consistent, but I'll definitely take a look and see if I can find similar size systems that have this and see if I can't get a compare and contrast on volume perhaps for the next iteration of this.
Thank you. Any other discussion?
Chair Carlo?
Yes, Regina Carlo. Where's that, Mr.
Thank you, Chief Auditor Sunberry. This is a really helpful report, and it's kind of what I had in mind. And I guess drilling down, it would be not if these are the categories that are measured nationally by, I guess it's the Navix Global, then within that, is there a breakdown by our eight institutions where the calls are coming from, so over time we can see if there's a trend that we need to be aware of to maybe recommend interventions or something? I mean, this is almost like a climate survey too, some of these categories.
Sure. Thank you, Regent Del Carlo, Joe Sunberry for the record. Yes, we do track that information by institution. That is information we can provide to the committee going forward. I think I can safely say that the amount of volume we see is appropriate for the size, respective size and number of students per institution at this point. But we do use some of that data to drive our audit plan. And if we do see a few calls coming into a particular area, we will make it a point to include that area on a future audit plan.
Any other discussion?
Thank you.
Seeing none, that was an information-only item. We'll go on to item number 8, new business. Is there any new business? Regent Hayes?
Just what I mentioned before about the CSN dental hygiene practice plan, maybe going to the full board.
Okay. Seeing no new business, no more business. We'll go to item number 9, public comment. I have no public comment that's been reported to me. So we'll adjourn this meeting.